Chapter 78. Artist. Breakfasts. Coffee with real cream, beef steaks, sausage, bacon, chops, eggs in various ways, potatoes in various, yes, and quite wonderful baked potatoes, and hot as fire. Dinners, all manner of things, including canvas-back duck, apollinaris, claret, champagne, etc. We sat up chatting till midnight, going and coming. Seldom read a line, day or night, though we were well fixed with magazines, etc. Semicolon. Then I finished off with a hot scotch and we went to bed, and slept till 9. 3:30 a.m. I honestly tried to pay my share of hotel bills, fees, etc., but I was not allowed and I knew the reason why, and respected the motive. I will explain when I see you, and then you will understand. We were 25 hours going to Chicago. We were there 24 hours. We were 30 hours returning. Brisk work, but all of it enjoyable. We insisted on leaving the car at Philadelphia, so that our waiter and cook, to whom Mr. R. gave $10 apiece, could have their Christmas Eve at home. Mr. Rogers' carriage was waiting for us in Jersey City, and deposited me at the Players. There, that's all. This letter is to make up for the 3 letterless days. I love you, dear heart, I love you all. SAML. XXXIV, Letters 1894. A Winter in New York. Business Failure. End of the machine, the beginning of the new year found Mark Twain sailing buoyantly on the tide of optimism. He believed that with H. Rogers as his financial pilot he could weather safely any storm or stress. He could divert himself, or rest, or work, and consider his business affairs with interest and amusement, instead of with haggard anxiety. He ran over to Hartford, to see an amateur play, to Boston to give a charity reading, to Fairhaven to open the library which Mr. Rogers had established there. He attended gay dinners, receptions, and late studio parties, acquiring the name of the Elle of New York. In the letters that follow we get the echo of some of these things. The Mrs. Rice mentioned in the next brief letter was the wife of Dr. Clarence 100. Rice, who had introduced H.H. Rogers to Mark Twain. To Mrs. Clemens, in Paris. January 12, 94. Livy darling, I came down from Hartford yesterday with Kipling, and he and Hutton and I at the small smoking compartment to ourselves, and found him at last at his ease, and not shy. He was very pleasant company indeed. He is to be in the city a week, and I wish I could invite him to dinner, but it won't do. I should be interrupted by business, of course. The construction of a contract that will suit Page's lawyer, not Page, turns out to be very difficult. He is embarrassed by earlier advice to Page, and hates to retire from it and stultify himself. The negotiations are being conducted by means of tedious long telegrams and by talks over the long-distance telephone. We keep the wires loaded. Dear me, dinner is ready. So Mrs. Rice says, with worlds of love, SAML. Clemens and Oliver Wendell Holmes had met and become friends soon after the publication of Innocents Abroad in 1869. Now, 25 years later, we find a record of what without doubt was their last meeting. It occurred at the home of Mrs. James T. Field. To Mrs. Clemens, in Paris. Boston, January 25, 94. Livy darling, I am caught out worse this time than ever before, in the matter of letters. Tuesday morning I was smart enough to finish, and mail my long letter to you before breakfast, for I was suspecting that I would not have another spare moment during the day. It turned out just so. In a thoughtless moment I agreed to come up here and read for the poor. I did not reflect that it would cost me 3 days. I could not get released. Yesterday I had myself called at 8, and ran out to Mr. Rogers' house at 9, and talked business until 10:30, then caught 11 o'clock train and arrived here at 6, was shaven and dressed by 7, and ready for dinner here in Mrs. Field's charming house. Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes never goes out now, he is in his 84th year. But he came out this time, said he wanted to have a time once more with me. Mrs. Fields said Aldrich begged to come and went away crying, because she wouldn't let him. She allowed only her family, Sarah Orne, Jude, and sister, to be present, because much company would overtax Dr. Holmes. Well, he was just delightful. He did as brilliant and beautiful talking and listening as ever he did in his life, I guess. Fields and Jewett said he hadn't been in such splendid form in years. He had ordered his carriage for 9. The coachman sent in for him at 9, but he said, oh, nonsense. Leave glories and grandeurs like these? Tell him to go away and come in an hour. At 10 he was called for again, and Mrs. Fields, getting uneasy, rose, but he wouldn't go, and so we rattled ahead the same as ever. Twice more Mrs. Fields rose, but he wouldn't go, and he didn't go till 10:30, an unwarrantable dissipation for him in these days. He was prodigiously complimentary about some of my books, and as having Pudd'nhead read to him. I told him you and I used the Autocrat as a courting book, and marked it all through, and that you keep it in the sacred green box with the love letters, and it pleased him. Goodbye, my dear darling, it is 15 minutes to dinner, and I'm not dressed yet. I have a reception tonight, and will be out very late at that place, and at Irving's Theater, where I have a complimentary box. I wish you were all here. SAML. In the next letter we meet James J. Corbett Entelman Jim, as he was sometimes called, the champion pugilist of that day. The Howells incident, so amusingly dramatized, will perhaps be more appreciated if the reader remembers that Mark Twain himself had at intervals been a mind-healing enthusiast. Indeed, in spite of his strictures on Mrs. Eddy, his interest in the subject of mind cure continued to the end of his life. To Mrs. Clemens, in Paris. Sunday, 9:30 a.m. Livy dear, when we got out to the house last night, Mrs. Rogers, who is up and around now, didn't want to go downstairs to dinner, but Mr. R. persuaded her, and we had a very good time indeed. By 8 o'clock we were down again, and bought a $15 box in the Madison Square Garden. Rogers bought it, not I. Then he went and fetched Dr. Rice, while I went to the Players, and picked up 2 artists, Reed and Simmons, and thus we filled 5 of the 6 seats. There was a vast multitude of people in the brilliant place. Stanford White came along presently, and invited me to go to the World Champion's dressing room, which I was very glad to do. Corbett has a fine face, and is modest and diffident, besides being the most perfectly and beautifully constructed human animal in the world. I said, you have whipped Mitchell, and maybe you will whip Jackson in June, but you are not done then. You will have to tackle me. He answered, so gravely that one might easily have thought him in earnest, no, I am not going to meet you in the ring. It is not fair or right to require it. You might chance to knock me out, by no merit of your own, but by a purely accidental blow, and then my reputation would be gone, and you would have a double one. You have got fame enough, and you ought not to want to take mine away from me. Corbett was for a long time a clerk in the Nevada Bank in San Francisco. There were lots of little boxing matches, to entertain the crowd. Then at last Corbett appeared in the ring and the 8,000 people present went mad with enthusiasm. My 2 artists went mad about his form. They said they had never seen anything that came reasonably near equaling its perfection except Greek statues, and they didn't surpass it. Corbett boxed 3 rounds with the middleweight Australian champion, oh, beautiful to see. Then the show was over, and we struggled out through a perfect wash of humanity. When we reached the street I found I had left my Arctics in the box. I had to have them, so Simmons said he would go back and get them, and I didn't dissuade him. I couldn't see how he was going to make his way a single yard into that solid oncoming wave of people, yet he must plow through it full 50 yards. He was back with the shoes in 3 minutes. How do you reckon he accomplished that miracle? By saying, "Way, gentlemen, please come in to fetch Mr. Corbett's overshoes." The word flew from mouth to mouth, the Red Sea divided, and Simmons walked comfortably through and back, dry shod. Simmons, this was revealed to me under seal of secrecy by Reed, is the hero of When, and he and Gwen's author were once engaged to marry. This is Iris Gape Simmons, the inveterate talker, you know : exit in case of Simmons. I had an engagement at a beautiful dwelling close to the players for 10:30. I was there by 10:45. 30 cultivated and very musical ladies and gentlemen present, all of them acquaintances, and many of them personal friends of mine. That wonderful Hungarian B, and was there, they charged $500 for an evening. Conversation and band until midnight, then a bite of supper, then the company was compactly grouped before me, and I told about Dr. B. E. Martin and the etchings, and followed it with the Scotch-Irish christening. My, but the Martin is a darling story. Next, the head tenor from the opera sang half a dozen great songs that set the company wild, yes, mad with delight, that nobly handsome young Damrosch accompanying on the piano. Just a little pause, then the band burst out into an explosion of weird and tremendous dance music. A Hungarian celebrity and his wife took the floor. I followed. I couldn't help it. The others drifted in, one by one, and it was on Tiora over again. By 4:30 I had danced all those people down and yet was not tired, merely breathless. I was in bed at 5, and asleep in 10 minutes. Up at 9 and presently at work on this letter to you. I think I wrote until 2:30. Then I walked leisurely out to Mr. Rogers. It is called 3 miles, but it is short of it, arriving at 3:30, but he was out to return at 5:30, and a person was in, whom I don't particularly like, so I didn't stay, but dropped over and chatted with the Howellses until 6. First, Howells and I had a chat together. I asked about Mrs. H. He said she was fine, still steadily improving, and nearly back to her old best health. I asked, as if I didn't know, what do you attribute this strange miracle to? Mind cure, simply mind cure. Lord, what a conversion. You were a scoffer 3 months ago. I wasn't. You were. You made elaborate fun of me in this very room. I did not, Clemens. It's a lie, Howells, you did. I detailed to him the conversation of that time with the stately argument furnished by Boyesen in the fact that a patient had actually been killed by a mind curist, and Howell's own smart remark that, when the mind curist is done with you, you have to call in a healer at last, because the former can't procure you a burial permit. At last he gave in. He said he remembered that talk, but had now been a mind curist so long it was difficult for him to realize that he had ever been anything else. Mrs. H. came skipping in, presently, the very person, to a dot, that she used to be, so many years ago. Mrs. H. said people may call it what they like, but it is just hypnotism, and that's all it is, hypnotism pure and simple. Mind cure. The idea. Why, this woman that cured me hasn't got any mind. She's a good creature, but she's dull and dumb, and illiterate and, now Eleanor. I know what I'm talking about. Don't I go there twice a week? And Mr. Clemens, if you could only see her wooden and satisfied face when she snubs me for forgetting myself, and showing by a thoughtless remark that to me weather is still weather, instead of being just an abstraction and a superstition, oh, it's the funniest thing you ever saw. And when she tilts up her nose, well, it's that kind of a nose that, now Eleanor, the woman is not responsible for her nose, and so on and so on. It didn't seem to me that I had any right to be having this feast, and you not there. She convinced me, before she got through, that she and William James are right. Hypnotism and mind cure are the same thing, no difference between them. Very well, The very source, the very center of hypnotism is Paris. Dr. Charcot's pupils and disciples are right there, and ready to your hand without fetching poor dear old Susie across the stormy sea. Let Mrs. McKay, to whom I send my best respects, tell you whom to go to learn all you need to learn, and how to proceed. Do it, honey. Don't lose a minute. At 11 o'clock last night, Mr. Rogers said, I am able to feel physical fatigue, and I feel it now. You never show any, either in your eyes or your movements. Do you ever feel any? I was able to say that I had forgotten what that feeling was like. Don't you remember how almost impossible it was for me to tire myself at the villa? Well, it is just so in New York. I go to bed unfatigued at 3, I get up fresh, and fine 6 hours later. I believe I have taken only one daylight nap since I have been here. When the anchor is down, then I shall say, farewell, a long farewell to business. I will never touch it again. I will live in literature, I will wallow in it, revel in it, I will swim in ink. Joan of Arc, but all this is premature. The anchor is not down yet. Tomorrow, Tuesday, I will add a P.S., if I've any to add. But, whether or no, I must mail this tomorrow, for the mail steamer goes next day. 5. 3:30 p.m. Great Scott, this is Tuesday. I must rush this letter into the mail instantly. Tell that sassy Ben I've got her welcome letter, and I'll write her, as soon as I get a daylight chance. I've most time at night, but I drew the right daytimes. SAML. The Reed and Simmons mentioned in the foregoing were Robert Reed and Edward Simmons, distinguished painter, the latter a brilliant, fluent, and industrious talker. The title, Fire Escape Simmons. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.